and Israel's unrelenting strikes claimed the lives of more women and children across Gaza, raising the genocidal war's death toll to over 44,700. Thank you for joining us. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian says the Syrian people are the ones who should decide the future of their country following its takeover by militants. Pezeshkian also called for dialogue amongst different Syrian groups to determine their fate in a peaceful environment away from any violence, concern or destructive external interference. The Iranian president stressed the need for maintaining unity among Syrians and preserving the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He expressed hope that violence and conflict in Syria would come to an end as soon as possible. Pezeshkian also highlighted the importance of ensuring the security of all Syrian citizens and protecting holy sites as well as diplomatic and consular missions in accordance with international law. Journalist Robert Fantina joined us earlier from Sydney with his take on Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian's remarks on the militant takeover of Syria.
The Iranian president mentioned several very important points. One is, and the key one, is that the future of Syria must be determined by the Syrian people. It must not be determined by the United States, which we know is going to want to establish a puppet government that will recognize Israel and that will abide by whatever the United States determines. This is not what the Syrian people want. They want to have their own country, their own form of government. It is they who must decide it. It's also important that any political prisoners be released and that the differing sects in the country, as the president, Iranian president mentioned, gather together to talk about how to resolve issues and differences in a peaceful way. This must be done by the Syrian people, for the Syrian people. The United States will come in and decide that they're going to broker an agreement, they're going to foster peace. That must not be allowed to happen. The United States and Israel must have no say whatsoever in the future of Syria. So I think we're seeing the beginning of a new era for the Syrian people.
Iran's foreign minister says the developments in Syria will not weaken the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Abbas Araghchi said Hezbollah's current munitions, equipment and facilities are enough for its resistance over the next 1 or 2 years. Regarding the collapse of the Syrian government, Araghchi said the country's army got entangled in psychological warfare. He underlined that if the army had withstood, even Aleppo would have not fallen to the militants. Araghchi added that during his recent meeting, he found President Bashar al-Assad surprised and complaining about the state of his army. The top diplomat said Syria has been one of the important members of the axis of resistance and played a significant role in confronting Israel and supporting Palestinians. Araghchi noted Iran is closely monitoring the developments and its approach will depend on the policy militant groups in the Arab country adopt towards the Islamic Republic. Iran's ambassador to Syria says the Iranian embassy staff in Damascus was safely evacuated and no one was harmed during the assault on the building.
It was precisely foreseen that if chaos prevailed in the city, definitely a part of the armed individuals would try to loot various centers and attack multiple other centers before the attacking party could establish order. Some of these places were exploited. Fortunately, we had no injuries. No one was harmed at the embassy, including our colleagues and local forces.
Hossein Akbari said some measures had been anticipated and equipment had been effectively evacuated, but the remaining assets were subjected to attacks, which is contrary to international law. Iran's ambassador noted that Syrian armed groups in question are not a single entity, but consist of various factions, some radical and extremist. However, he emphasized that they are not like Daesh, as they have fought against them in the past. The ambassador pointed out that these factions have fundamental ideological differences. Also, as the Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory indiscriminately, in one of the latest attacks, over 24 Palestinians, including women and children, were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed the Al Buraj refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli airstrikes on a vehicle in the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza also caused fatalities. Casualties were also reported after Israeli drones struck several areas across Gaza, including the Nuseirat refugee camp. The regime's relentless air raids in the southern city of Rafah led to the deaths of several people as well. More than 44,700 Palestinians have so far been killed and 106,000 others injured since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in October last year. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabbe to get further details regarding the Israeli attacks across the besieged territory. Let's take a listen.
Yes, then actually it was another destructive and a bloody day for the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip, whereas the Israeli occupation forces ramped up their attacks against multiple areas of the besieged enclave. And let me begin with the middle area of Gaza Strip, whereas another horrific massacre unfolded in Al Burwaj refugee camp after the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building there, killing 11 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children as usual. Many of them are still believed missing under the rubble. In the meantime, the Al-Nusrat refugee camp witnessed more brutal airstrikes, whereas over the past couple of hours, at least three successive airstrikes and raids hit different parts of Al-Nusrat refugee camp, targeting the residential buildings and apartments there. The first one took place a short while ago after the Israeli warplanes targeted a residential apartment, leaving scores of the Palestinian casualties. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery continued and intensified their shelling against the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp, whereas a big blaze erupted in the warehouses and the stores in that area, revealing how extensive that attack was against the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp.
The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees slams the long-standing failure of the international community to resolve the Palestinian issue.
It's 75 years of a temporary lasting organization. So if we are still here 75 years later, there is no doubt that this is the expression of a collective failure of the international community to have promoted a fair and lasting political solution on the Palestinian issue.
That's Arini, while speaking at the annual Doha Forum, commented on the history of UNRWA, stressing that the refugee agency was intended to be a temporary establishment. He said Israel's war on Gaza has killed 250 UNRWA personnel, with many of them losing their lives alongside their relatives. Lazzarini also pointed to the Israeli attacks on the agency's premises since October last year. He rejected Israeli claims that the UNRWA facilities have been used by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The Israeli parliament in October passed two laws that ban UNRWA from operating throughout the occupied Palestinian territories. Israel continues to breach the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon as the regime has carried out more aerial aggression against the Arab country. Three civilians, including a woman, were killed in a drone attack on Debine in southern Lebanon. There are reports of Israeli drone activity in Nabatea and Tyre as well. Israeli forces also entered a minefield on Lebanon's border with the occupied Palestinian territories, killing one person and injuring a number of others. The truce between Israel and Lebanon took effect on November 27th. But since then, Israel has repeatedly violated the ceasefire. The Israeli aggression against Lebanon since October last year has taken the lives of over 4,000 people. Yemen has once again hit a vital Israeli target in the occupied Palestinian territories. The spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces said the drone attack was carried out in cooperation with the Islamic Resistance in Iraq and in solidarity with the people of Gaza.
Triumphing for the oppression of the Palestinian people and their mujahideen, and in response to the crimes of the Israeli enemy against our people in Gaza, the Yemeni armed forces, in cooperation with the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, carried out a military operation targeting a vital target in southern occupied Palestine with a number of drones. The operation achieved its goals successfully. The Yemeni armed forces, alongside the mujahideen of the Iraqi resistance, continue to respond to the crimes of the Israeli enemy against our people in the Gaza Strip. These operations will not stop until the aggression stops and the siege on the Gaza Strip is lifted.
Thousands of demonstrators rallied in Pakistan's Peshawar to protest the Israeli military actions in Gaza. The rally, themed Down with Israel, drew participants from across the country to condemn the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the besieged Palestinian territory. Our correspondent, Nasser Kazmi, has more details in this report.
Thousands of Pakistanis took to the streets of Peshawar on Sunday to denounce what they called U.S.-backed Israeli aggression in Gaza. Supporters of Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam, a prominent political party in Pakistan, joined by seminary students, gathered for a rally where they voiced anti-U.S. and anti-Israel sentiments ahead of the Down with Israel conference. The conference brought together participants from all four provinces of Pakistan in a powerful show of solidarity with Palestinians.
Down with Israel is the voice of the world now. How can we stay silent while innocent women and children are being slaughtered in Gaza? This is not just a Palestinian issue. It's a matter of humanity.
Protesters urged the global community to exert pressure on Israel to stop its blockade of Gaza and facilitate the free flow of aid, ensuring that Palestinian civilians have access to life-saving necessities.
Israel's actions are nothing short of genocide. The Muslim world must unite to stop this injustice.
Palestine.
We are here to raise our voices for the voiceless people of Palestine. We condemn the United States and Israel for their genocidal actions in Gaza.
In addition to widespread public sentiment, the Pakistani government has been among the most vocal nations in urging Israel to announce an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in Gaza.
The genocide in Gaza must end. Civilians are being indiscriminately killed, including at food points, hospitals, and refugee shelters. This humanitarian situation needs urgent international attention.
At the United Nations General Assembly, Pakistan's special envoy urged the formal recognition of Palestine as a sovereign state and advocated for its swift admission as a full member of the UN.
Pakistanis expressed anger at the international community's failure to implement a ceasefire in Gaza, where tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians have been killed in recent months, including women and children. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Meanwhile, thousands have taken to the streets in Sydney, rallying in solidarity with the people of Gaza. Protesters are demanding justice and calling on the government to boycott and divest from Israel over the regime's genocidal war. Our correspondent reports from the heart of the demonstration.
Sydneysiders have gathered in large numbers at the city's central district, raising their voices in unison to demand justice for Gaza. The crowd, undeterred by rain and sun, is calling for urgent international attention.
How many more need to die? How many more children like me need to struggle? How many need to lose their parents, siblings and family? Because this is not just their fight, it is our fight. It is a fight for justice, equality and humanity. We do not just stand against the occupation. We stand against the principle that some lives are worth more than others.
Australia has shifted its stance, backing a UN resolution urging Israel to end its unlawful presence in Palestinian territories. While activists welcome the move, they argue it's an election ploy unless Australia imposes sanctions and severs ties with Israel. The resolution saw 157 nations in favour, with 8 opposed.
It's very clear what they're doing. They're very cynical. They know that there's an election coming up.
Yes!
They know that many seats of theirs that they rely on to hold government, have very large Arab and Muslim populations. They know that there's massive opposition to their policy on the genocide in Gaza. And they think now that making some cynical, tokenistic gesture in the United Nations might be able to save their skins in the next election.
Demonstrators are demanding tough action against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, accusing him of orchestrating a genocidal war in Gaza and Lebanon that has claimed tens of thousands of lives. Protesters say justice must be served to end the bloodshed. Since October 2023, not a single Sunday has passed without protesters filling Sydney's streets. Week after week, demonstrators are reminding the world of its moral obligation to act and bring an end to what they call Israel's apartheid regime.
Israel can only act with impunity, with the support of international players and international institutions. So we need to continue to mobilize on this colony until we see liberation in our lands.
Amnesty International's recent report concluded that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, a point that has intensified calls for action in Australia. Protesters are urging the Australian government to advocate for Gaza's human rights amid growing accusation of complicity through silence.
Palestine will be free!
This unwavering commitment by the people in Australia for the people of Gaza stands as a powerful testament to the enduring hope in humanity's capacity for justice and compassion. Shahana Bhatt, Sydney.
Ali Ramazani, Tehran.
Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Beset by problems at home, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has developed a taste for international diplomacy. But Trump's protectionism and Brexit's legacy make his position abroad even weaker. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, it's usually a sign of a failing, end-of-the-line prime ministerships, when the incumbent becomes obsessed with foreign policy trips abroad. So it was for Margaret Thatcher, who was actually removed while in Paris, and for Tony Blair and his government, lost with all hands in the sea of troubles that was the Iraq invasion and its consequences. But Keir Starmer seems to have begun how others ended. As of November 11, 2024, Starmer has visited each of Belgium, Hungary, Ireland, Italy, and Samoa once. He has also visited France, Germany, and the United States three times each. Starmer may, like his predecessors, be fleeing domestic political misery, his first 100 days being now infamously deflating, not least due to his opinion poll ratings. Although this is a case of early onset political misery, that's 14 trips, nearly one a week, since he became a prime minister. And there is more coming up with visits to Saudi Arabia and the UAE next year. No wonder Starmer has earned the Westminster nickname, Gap Year Care. But the oddity is that Starmer is hardly moving into an international arena where he can strike a heroic pose, as Thatcher thought she was doing on the post-Cold War stage, or Blair thought he was doing in Iraq, until the reality is caught up with him. Indeed, Starmer's international situation is at least as perilous as his domestic one. First off, the hinge on which all UK foreign policy turns, the special relationship with the US, can rarely have looked so troublesome for an incoming British Prime Minister. Donald Trump, as he has made abundantly and publicly clear, hates the Labour Party. He hates it in general ideological terms. He has long hated its Muslim mayor of London, and he detests the fact that Labour Party members went to work for Kamala Harris' doomed campaign. And Labour cabinet members, at least in their pre-office holding, free speech days, made it clear what they thought of Trump. And no one had been clearer than the new Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who, before he was charged with the nation's diplomacy, called Trump a neo-Nazi sympathising psychopath. Lammy, not a mind to whom second thoughts come easily, has now done some FCO-inspired grovelling. But Trump is famously vengeful and petty, so it's unlikely to rehabilitate him in the president-elect's eyes. Now, it might be said that this political animosity will be a marginal issue and that the relations between states will survive the incompatibility of personalities and ideology. But that may be wishful thinking, for there are matters of substance at stake that will trouble the alliance, perhaps more than it has been troubled since the Suez Crisis in 1956. Trump is an isolationist. The US regime has not had a president like that, with exception of Trump's first presidency since before the Second World War. If Trump keeps his campaign promise, quite the if, admittedly, then trade tariffs are coming. Aimed specifically, but not only at China, they may hit the UK as well. If they do, the already fragile UK economy will take a battering, £22 billion, according to some experts. That's the same scale as Chancellor Rachel Reeves' black hole in the national finances. If the Trump tariff hit happens, the cost of living will ratchet up again, at a time when workers have not recovered from that last spate of corporate price gouging. If Trump excludes the UK from his tariffs, there will be a price likely the UK joining with Trump's trade war. And that too will be a costly option as China remains the UK's sixth biggest trading partner, just after France and ahead of Italy and Spain. Secondly, the Ukraine war will provide another stumbling block. Volodymyr Zelensky's government is clearly losing the war. Trump has, in a typical boast, said he could end the war in a day, that is, buffoonery, of course. But the isolationists in Trump and the realists in other members of the US foreign policy elite may coincide in the conclusion that now is the time to cut their losses in Ukraine. The whole point of a proxy war is that you are supposed to defeat your enemy without engaging your own forces. Yet the war is increasingly looking like it can't be won without direct or at least more direct Western firepower. Starmer seems to have no qualms about that, as his advocacy of allowing Ukraine to fire British Storm Shadow missiles into the Russian interior demonstrates. But Trump may take another view and leave the British and Europeans to unravel the pro-Ukrainian ideology they have so carefully constructed as best they can. It's quite something that the British establishment has managed to find itself at odds with the two major trade blocs that determine the shape of the British economy. But that's where Trump's protectionism and Brexit have left them. Starmer really has no answer to this double danger. He will, of course, try and suck up to Trump, but there is a limit to how far that can go. Starmer will never succeed in outbidding the real Trump sycophants like Nigel Farage and the dominant far-right leadership of the Tory party. And it will hardly convince Trump's well-developed ear for genuine obsequiousness. As the most destructive war in Europe confounds the Ukraine hawks, Starmer among them, and as the trade war finds the UK ground between the rock of Trump's protectionism and the legacy of Boris Johnson's Brexit, he may soon long to return to the relative warmth of a sceptical and disillusioned electorate in Britain.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Seeking Knowledge. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Sister Zainab with you on A to Z on IRIB English Radio. I'm talking to you today about seeking knowledge. So we know, we've all heard that obviously we're supposed to gain some extra knowledge every single day. There should not be a day in our lives where we sort of go to sleep and we haven't gained some extra insight, a little bit of extra knowledge. And we also know, for example, that we are encouraged to travel as far as China, basically to the other side of the world, seeking knowledge. This is how important knowledge is. So let's just have a look at what knowledge actually is and what is the best kind of knowledge and how can we guarantee that, you know, we're going to benefit from this knowledge. And is this knowledge, for example, for this world, or does it have any other sort of benefits for us? So there's a hadith, for example, that tells us that knowledge is not extensive learning. Rather, it's a light that God casts in the heart of whomever he wills. So we know. So obviously when we, and just imagine this to yourself, so many of us obviously go to university, maybe some people have prolonged, sustained learning periods because maybe they do their bachelor's, their master's, their PhD, some people do postdocs. Now just remember, so when you embark on and I'm just going to remind you, when we embark on a journey of learning, whether it's on a daily basis, maybe before you go to uni, or when you're embarking on a new course of study, maybe some online learning you're doing, for example, during Ramadan, then just remember to set your intention also. Set the intention. This learning is obviously always for proximity to Allah to learn more about the faith. So this is not just for yourself. It's not just to please other people, to show off to other people, for example. Now, the fact that, so knowledge is, and we hear this a lot, that knowledge is a light that God puts in our heart. Welcome back. This is Sister Zainab with you on A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So I'm talking to you about seeking knowledge. So I'm just trying to talk a little bit about knowledge being light. And obviously, so it's all our knowledge comes from Allah. We cannot hold ourselves responsible for anything, really, unless the bad things, of course, we are held solely responsible for. Remember that. But in terms of gaining knowledge, this is always a blessing that we receive from Allah. Now, this light, Allah can give this knowledge to anyone, however much knowledge Allah wants to give to that person. So we could be engaged in formal learning. But if we're not doing it for the correct purpose, for example, if our desires are quite egoistic, we're doing it for status, to please others, to show off, just to get a high-paid job, for example. Well, maybe that light is not going to shine into our hearts quite as much. And maybe we don't actually get the full scope, the full breadth of that learning anyway. So that's one part. The other part is, imagine there are people who are deprived even of the opportunity to engage in formal learning. They can't access online learning. They can't, for example, go to university because maybe they have to go to work. They're deprived of those opportunities. But just imagine if that person has really pure intention, really wants to understand their faith better, really wants to gain proximity to Allah. Allah can make any and all knowledge available. So this person can still have full benefit. And obviously, what is it that's one of the most important things on the path to knowledge while we're learning? That is purifying the soul. There's no way around it. And at the end of the day, what we don't want, we know that in the Quran it says people are asleep and they wake up on death. We don't want to be amongst the people who wake up when we die. We want to have that pure heart. We want to have learned. So we want to actually wake up during this life, inshallah. So that's just a few insights for you on that topic. And inshallah, you join us on another A to Z on RB English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, said families in the Gaza Strip are facing dire conditions due to repeated displacement, reiterating the urgent need for an immediate ceasefire. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, around 60,000 Palestinians in the northern Gaza Strip are living in catastrophic conditions under the Israeli siege that has been ongoing for more than 60 days, according to a spokesperson for UNRWA, UN Relief Agency for Palestine Refugees. Jonathan Fowler, UNRWA's Senior Director of Communications, in an interview with the Anadolu news agency said, "This is an absolutely unprecedented level of tragedy. It's an unprecedented humanitarian crisis." Describing the situation as perfectly catastrophic, Fowler said, "Everywhere you look, all the indicators are completely disastrous. The lack of medicine, the lack of food, the lack of drinking water, the lack of access, the constant displacement, the death, the destruction, the missing people." Almost 2 million people in Gaza were entirely reliant on humanitarian aid to survive, the spokesperson stressed. Fowler emphasized, "This is a man-made disaster, and it's absolutely unconscionable that this continues." The UNRWA official explained that it's not complicated to understand that if you need 500 trucks of food and other supplies a day, and you're only getting 70, 80, 90, that is why people are suffering so severely. Palestinians in northern Gaza are completely cut off, Fowler continued. They have no food, they have no water, there is not even any ambulances. Overall, the north is one of the most affected areas of the entire Gaza Strip, said the spokesperson. That pocket is the sort of epicenter of the current humanitarian tragedy, and that this again is a reason why there has to be access for humanitarians and there has to be an immediate ceasefire. He warned, due to the absolute level of tragedy there, people will be dying of hunger in those besieged areas as there is nothing to eat, Fowler stated. The responsibility to protect aid workers and aid supplies falls upon the occupying power. And that is the regime of Israel. And so everything must be done by the Israeli regime authorities to ensure that aid flows safely to Gaza. Flouting a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, the Zionist regime has faced international condemnation amid its continued brutal offensive on Gaza. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the child killer regime of Israel has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 45,000 Palestinians have been murdered and at least 105,740 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7, 2023. Moreover, at least 11,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international organizations say that the majority of those murdered and wounded are women and children. The Israeli regime war has resulted in acute famine in Gaza, mostly in the northern parts of Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. The Zionist regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah, near the border with Egypt, in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Later in the war, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began moving from the south to central Gaza in a constant search for safety. In the meantime, Wafaa News Agency wrote, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, said recently that families in the Gaza Strip are facing dire conditions due to repeated displacement, reiterating the urgent need for an immediate ceasefire. The UN agency added in a post on X, in Deir al-Balah, in the central of the Gaza Strip and throughout the Gaza Strip, families continue to face dire conditions. It explained that these families are being displaced repeatedly due to the ongoing shelling and are seeking shelter in crowded UNRWA schools and temporary tents and are struggling to access basic necessities. It reiterated the urgent need for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and ensuring unhindered access to humanitarian assistance that meets the growing needs. The ongoing aggression waged by the occupation since October 7, 2023 has forced about 2 million of the Strip's citizens, numbering about 2.3 million Palestinians, to be displaced in tragic conditions with a deliberate severe shortage of food, water and medicine. Famine has spread in most areas of the Gaza Strip as a result of the ongoing aggression, especially in the north, following the persistence of genocide and starvation to force citizens to migrate south.
Israel Watch welcomes you. Today we will discuss the recent violations of the ceasefire by the occupying army in Lebanon, Hezbollah's response, and the concerns of northern settlers about a potential return to the war. Additionally, we will touch on the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the veiled threats from President Donald Trump to Hamas regarding the release of the captives. Joining us for this discussion is Dr. Mahdi Aqil, a researcher in regional affairs. Welcome, Doctor. Following a series of Israeli violations of the ceasefire in Lebanon, Hezbollah retaliated by launching missiles at an Israeli military position in the occupied Sheba farms. This has sparked a wave of anxiety among northern settlers and raised numerous questions in the Hebrew media about the implications of this response on the ceasefire agreement. Dr. Mahdi Aqil, based on what we've just discussed, how do you assess Hezbollah's response to the Israeli violations of the ceasefire, and what achievements have they made regarding the deterrence equation they are working on?
Initially, we want to discuss the situation following the ceasefire that took place at dawn of November 27th. After this, Israel has continued to violate agreements, particularly in the southern and even more so in the northern Litani region. It seems they interpreted the freedom of movement granted to them, which was not included in the agreement text, but was assured by the United States as a right they could claim. However, Hezbollah was vigilant and responded to these actions, particularly through their operation targeting the site of the heads of the regime. Regardless of whether there were military casualties or not, this incident has set a preliminary framework for future engagement rules between Hezbollah and the Israeli army. If Israel continues to overstep its bounds, we might find ourselves back in a situation reminiscent of pre-2000, which Hezbollah and the people of the south will not accept.
Well, we have observed that the Hebrew media is expressing significant concerns about the potential repercussions of the resistance response to these Israeli violations. What did these fears indicate in light of the fragile ceasefire?
The Israeli achievements, while notable, should be recognized as tactical successes focused on targeting Hezbollah leaders and striking their missile platforms and storage facilities. However, the Israeli perspective was that they were entering an existential war with Lebanon or Hezbollah, which ultimately resulted in a limited conflict and an agreement based on the 1701 resolution. If you reflect on the resolution of 1701 in 2006 and compare it to the agreement of today, there were many similarities. The Israeli narrative questions how they transitioned from declaring an existential war to concluding with the 1701 resolution, which mirrors the outcomes of the 2006 war. Israel did not achieve a strategic victory in eliminating Hezbollah, but it does not imply the end of the war. Currently, we see a ceasefire, yet Israel continues its attacks against the resistance axis, particularly targeting Hezbollah. When their ground offensive against Hezbollah faltered, they shifted their focus to Syria, where operations are aimed at undermining and containing Hezbollah's influence in the region.
However, Dr. Aqil, the question remains, what about the northern settlers? It's clear that their concerns about returning have increased after Hezbollah's response to these persistent Israeli attacks.
It's clear that we often find ourselves comparing the settlers in the north with the residents of southern Lebanon. The latter waited no longer than the last moments of shooting on November 27 to head south back to their own homes. In contrast, the northern settlers come from various European, African, or Arab countries seeking safety, stability, and prosperity in a new land. However, they now face an existential struggle against a military organization known as Hezbollah, which they find difficult to adapt to. This is quite different from the Lebanese people, who have endured attacks from the Israeli enemy and have learned to stand firm in a defense of their homeland where their ancestors are buried. This land is irreplaceable for them. The distinction between these two groups is significant, and many settlers may never return to the north, as it remains a threatened area, likely to see a fourth war with Hezbollah, prompting them to avoid going back. ولابد من وقوع حرب رابعة مع حزب الله لذلك يتجنبون العودة إلى الشمال.
We continue to observe the northern settlers who are hesitant about returning to the border settlements with Lebanon despite the ceasefire. They are closely watching how the administration will handle their return and the reconstruction of damage caused to these settlements by Hezbollah's missiles and drones over the past year and 2 months. Dr. Mahdi Aqil, do you really think, based on what we've seen, that Netanyahu's administration can convince the northern settlers to return through this financial compensation they've allocated for improving these settlements?
The issue of security remains the primary concern for the settlers in the north, regardless of the economic aid provided for factories and institutions. It's important to recognize that the north attracts a significant number of industrial and agricultural facilities within the Israeli entity, but this is not enough for the settlers. They seek a sense of safety, especially with Hezbollah's presence in Lebanon posing a threat. As you mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, the situation is critical, particularly with Hezbollah's missiles still being a concern. They will never forget the Sunday when Hezbollah fired over 350 missiles at the Israeli entity, which is known among the Israelis as the Black Sunday, indicating that Hezbollah retains substantial military capabilities that continue to threaten both the entity and its northern residents. Consequently, while some settlers may find comfort in economic development, the majority remain preoccupied with security fears. This ongoing anxiety has led to Israeli actions, including attacks and strikes on various sites, as they aim to target Hezbollah and reassure the settlers. However, the situation appears to be far from stable.
This lack of trust in the administration and the occupying army, is there any protection for them?
The topic of security is undoubtedly central to the Israeli entity, which has been focused on military and security matters since 1948. David Ben-Gurion, the founder of this entity, envisioned it as being constantly under threat while striving to maintain superiority in the region. However, a party known as Hezbollah emerged at least after the year 2000, presenting a new dynamic that challenged the Israeli military in ways that no official or unofficial military force had done before. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, may he rest in peace, established a balance of power that was unprecedented. This reality is difficult for the Israelis to accept, which explains the ongoing Israeli aggression and wars in Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and potentially Iraq, even reaching Iran. We are witnessing a series of continuous wars where it is a matter of either us or them.
The financial allocations approved by Netanyahu's administration for rebuilding settlements near the border with Lebanon in preparation for the return of the settlers do not convince many of them. They express their concerns and lack of trust in the administration's and military's ability to protect them upon their return, as seen in various Hebrew media outlets. While this Kiryat Shimona has doubts about returning and feeling safe, what are the signs that have led to this?
There's no doubt we've discussed the topic of security before, which has been a significant concern for Israelis since the establishment of this entity. On the economic front, there are discussions in Israel suggesting that the economic situation is quite fragile. While it does benefit from support from the U.S. and the West, ultimately Israel is an entity with institutions, factories, stock market, and banks. Financial support alone is not sufficient, as evidenced by the significant drop in Israel's credit rating. The economy is considered weak. In addition, the ruling system in Israel is also faltering on the democratic level, a shaky democracy on the political level. Currently, there is a stark divide between the political and military levels. Just a few days ago, Daniel Hagari, the official spokesperson for the Israeli army, apologized for overstepping his bounds regarding his criticism of the law on information disclosure to the prime minister, which led to a reprimand from the chief of staff. It's noteworthy that while the army has historically had the support of all the regime's institutions, the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, recently stated quite clearly that we have a country with an army, not an army with a country.
It seems that this settler is expressing a significant viewpoint shared by many in the community, highlighting their feelings of neglect from the administration. This raises concerns about how much sentiment might affect the situation in the coming phases.
The repercussions of October 7th, the Gaza war, and the Lebanon war undoubtedly cast a shadow over the entire Israeli entity. However, the northern region has been suffering since the very beginning, around October 7th or 8th, when Hezbollah's assistance front emerged and the settlers were displaced. Many of these individuals viewed themselves as second-class Israeli citizens, receiving far less attention compared to areas like Tel Aviv. When Tel Aviv or Haifa faced threats from Hezbollah, it caused a significant uproar within the Israeli community, while the northern residents were largely overlooked. Even when efforts were made to return them to the settlements, the process was not organized in a way that ensured their safety from Hezbollah's ongoing presence. Even the Redwan neighborhood still exists. The fear remains that Hezbollah will not abandon the southern Litani region. They may appear to withdraw, but the residents of that area are still considered to Hezbollah, are still connected to Hezbollah. Some Israeli reports suggest that through reconstruction efforts in the south, Hezbollah might be re-establishing its military presence or infrastructure. As a result, this settler living in the north is unlikely to feel secure or free from the anxieties associated with Hezbollah.
The accusation of the former Israeli Minister of War, Moshe Yaalon, that the occupation army is committing ethnic cleansing in the Gaza Strip continues to cause a lot of repercussions within the entity. The Hebrew media is particularly focused on the current operations of the military in Gaza, especially in the areas of Jabalia and Beit Lahia in the northern part of the territory. It's clear that the Israeli occupation forces are committing acts of genocide, displacement, and ethnic cleansing in Gaza, as acknowledged by Moshe Yaalon. What is the goal of these genocidal actions if they have not achieved the declared goals of the aggression on Gaza?
There's no doubt that the time has come for Israel to wage an existential war in the region. While stuck in this quagmire, how do they aim to eliminate the entire axis of resistance? The events of October 7 shook the entity, reminiscent of its early days in 1948. Consequently, I believe that the attack on Gaza will not stop. The war with Israel will continue, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon, albeit in different forms. Currently, there is an Egyptian proposal suggesting the opening of the Rafah crossing, transferring control to the Palestinian Authority and repositioning the Israeli army along the Philadelphia Corridor and Netzarim. This arrangement would involve certain conditions over a 60-day period in exchange for the release of 33 Israeli captives or fewer. However, this indicates that any potential solution may be gradual and might not lead to a happy ending, especially since Israel is unlikely to accept a return of Hamas to Gaza after October 7. There's this foolish general's plan which focuses on clearing the north of its residents and rebuilding settlements, rebuilding Gush Etzion, which is in that area. We seem to be heading into a completely different phase. They seek something that takes them back to the situation before October 7. The overall vision remains unclear, and while the general's plan is in place, circumstances could change if a different agreement is reached. However, as long as the war continues, Netanyahu and his right-wing administration are unlikely to back down. This puts us in a scenario where multiple outcomes are possible.
The question arises, to what extent might Netanyahu resort to this genocide against the people of Gaza, especially considering he is currently accused of war crimes and facing international legal action?
We observed in Lebanon, for instance, that after the ceasefire agreement, the French authorities replaced the demand for him with a greeting, meaning he was no longer wanted by the French authorities. The United States could certainly influence the situation through its pressure on the International Criminal Court. Today, for example, Judge Karim Khan, who issued the arrest warrant, is being tried. Those who dominate the world can easily overlook such matters if they allow Netanyahu to commit this genocide for over a year and 2 months. It's not surprising that they will permit even more.
We continue to observe the situation in Gaza, focusing on the threat issued by Trump to Hamas regarding the release of the Zionist captives. This demand came after a request from Netanyahu's wife and also Minister Dermer, and has sparked significant discussion in the Hebrew media, which is questioning whether Trump will follow through on his threats. Well, Dr. Aqil, Donald Trump's remarks regarding Hamas included a threat related to the release of the Zionist captives. How do you interpret this statement in the current context?
This threat is usually considered an act of disavowal in Israel, as the Post said a little while ago, with regard to what Hamas has been through and the genocide there. What more can Trump do to them? Some in Israel believe that cutting off Hamas's financial resources, particularly the funds that come from Qatar, could be effective. They suggest that preventing Qatar from sending money to Hamas or questionable organizations in the U.S. or Europe could limit Hamas's financial support. Hamas may obtain money from these associations through devious means. Additionally, there is the issue of Iran, which could potentially be pressured to stop providing financial aid to Hamas. Lastly, the Hebrew media discusses the possibility of hindering the reconstruction efforts in Gaza, which could also serve as a threat to Hamas. These three factors are seen as potential ways to challenge Hamas, although their effectiveness may be limited.
When Donald Trump threatens Hamas, how do you think he is giving Netanyahu more freedom and power militarily?
There is no military threat at this point. Netanyahu has done nothing but cause destruction and violence. Just last night, we heard about the attacks on Jabalia and the strikes in northern and southern Gaza. Every possible action has been taken, and every international law and humanitarian principle has been violated in Gaza. But the financial aspect is what he can threaten Hamas with. It might also serve as a dual warning to Netanyahu that he needs to end the war in Gaza before January 20, when Trump enters the White House.
قبل 21 من السنة الجديدة أي قبل دخول ترامب إلى البيت الأبيض. ولكن ماذا
عن التمييز؟ Today there is a push for Trump to finalize the agreement regarding the Gaza Strip.
بالنسبة لقطاع غزة اليوم.
He wants to enter the White House, according to his advisors. I mean, his Lebanese advisor for the West Asia states that he aims to step into the White House almost free of wars, wars in both in Gaza and in Lebanon. There's even a suggestion regarding Ukraine to freeze the situation there for many years to halt the war. Later on, discussions could take place about the occupied areas, considering them as Ukrainian land that Russia has taken over.
على المناطق المحتلة باعتبار أنه ليس أنها أرض أوكرانية التي استولت عليها روسيا.
Dr. Mahdi Aqil, a researcher in regional affairs. Thank you for joining us. Goodbye until we meet again.
تحياتي بأمان. We'll be right back.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, and we're welcome to another episode of the program.